these things had transcended death. The power they held was beyond anything taught here at the Academy. Before it, both Jedi and Sith were nothing, less than nothing, infinitesimal crumbs in the vast expanse of the universe. Lusk saw the things around him crowding closer, and that was when he realized it. It wasn't enough just to be transformed, to see the world with these new necroscopic eyes. The sickness had given him its gift, but it wanted something in return, something crippling and enormous. And now, belatedly, Lusk grasped what it was. The sickness wanted that part of him that made him who he was, that exceptional set of skills and memories and quirks that had made him unique. The sickness meant to siphon all of that away so that it could make him part of the greater, swelling organism of the dead. The sickness wanted his soul. "No," Lusk told it. "It's too much. Even for what you offer, even for immortality itself, the price is too high." "I will make you the last one," the sickness promised. "Of all the others, you alone shall endure. That is what I have to offer you." "No." The sickness paused within him, considering. "That is too bad, because you no longer have a choice in the matter." Placing his hand over his chest, Lusk felt his heart stop beating. All around him, the newly dead were screaming, screaming. He threw back his head and opened his mouth. And he, too, began to scream. Chapter 29, 1174-AA. Ra'at found the weapons cache just before they reached the barrier. He'd heard that these tunnels were lined with subchambers and cysts. Some of them hundreds of years old as the Academy itself. According to the rumors, generations of Sith Lords had used them for storage or hiding places for things they never wanted found. He and Kindra had found the first of the chambers 20 minutes after the group had finished watching the training droid's hologram. Nobody had spoken much since then. They had moved in silence, listening. "Look," Kindra said, pointing at the badly oxidized metal sign bracketed onto the wall. It read, "Arsenal 1174-AA. "Give me a hand," Ra'at said, taking hold of the handle. It was a rudimentary side hatch whose stubborn refusal to open was less a matter of security and more a result of the moisture and grit that had accumulated inside its components over the years. Mags grabbed one edge, and Hartwig and Kindra took the other, and it came open with a metallic clang. They all stood for a moment, peering in. Hartwig whistled. "That's the most beautiful sight I've seen in a long time," he said. Ra'at had to agree with him. The bin in front of them was loaded with gear. Some basic melee weapons, and body armor for training purposes, headpieces and blast-dampening chest plates. And in the back, in a separate wall mount, 3 lightsabers. Kindra reached past him and grabbed one in each hand. As Ra'at took the last one for himself, he wondered why she'd taken 2, and guessed she was just optimizing her chances of getting a fully functional weapon. Although the power cells were supposed to hold an almost indefinite charge, there was no telling if any of them still worked, or even how long they'd been stashed down here. As often as he'd trained with them, lightsabers still held an arcane sense of mystery that made them both fascinating and vaguely unsettling, a link to the Sith's ancient past. Ra'at thumbed the activation plate, and the scarlet blade sprang to life. He could feel it vibrating up from hand to elbow, the sheer authoritative power of it humming through his entire arm, giving it purpose and strength. He brought the blade up in front of his face, admiring it, feeling the small, fine hairs stiffen on the backs of his arms. Next to him, Kindra had switched on both of hers as well. "Mags," she said, and tossed him the one in her left hand. He caught it effortlessly, Thanks. Hartwig frowned. Wait a second, where's mine? There were only three. So, what, I'm out of luck? Kendra shrugged, and Ra'at realized the other reason she'd grabbed two instead of one. It had allowed her to decide who carried the third. She had given it to Mags, who, while not the most proficient duelist, was probably the least likely to snap under pressure and take one of their heads off, either by accident or in a fit of poor judgment. Flay that noise, Hartwig said. We should draw lots to see who gets what. Otherwise what? Kendra asked. She was still holding her remaining lightsaber in front of her, regarding Hartwig coldly from behind its blade. You'll leave? Good riddance. It's everyone for themselves, anyway. Hartwig glared at Kendra with a glint of righteous indignation that Ra'at guessed was eventually going to get him killed. Kendra, however, had already seemed to have lost interest in him. She deactivated the lightsaber, clipped it onto her belt, and began eyeing the corridor ahead of them. Come on, let's keep going. There might be another weapons dump up this way. Don't turn your back on me, Hartwig said. Is that a threat? Just a warning. She unclipped the lightsaber. Then I guess I'll just kill you now, won't I? You... Kendra's arm whipped upward. The blade was already ignited, sweeping up in a lethal blur, halting centimeters from Hartwig's throat. Stepping back, Hartwig glanced over at Mags and saw him waiting to see what would happen. For a long moment, neither of them moved or spoke, and the only sound inside the tunnel was the faint, steady hum of the lightsaber itself. "You won't do that," Hartwig said. "You need me too much." But what he'd obviously intended to be defiance came out as little more than a strangled-sounding squeak. Kendra didn't answer, just stood riveted to his gaze. The blade stayed where it was. Ra'at saw how its light reflected off the beads of sweat that had begun to accumulate on Hartwig's upper lip. "Kendra," Ra'at started, "shut up." "He's right. You saw those things in the hollow. We're outnumbered. We need every..." "I'll tell you what I don't need." She still hadn't taken her eyes off Hartwig. "I don't need to constantly be looking over my shoulder." She nodded, seeming to decide something in that moment. "No, Hartwig. I think I'm going to have to finish your sorry carcass off right now." Hartwig's lip twitched, trying to make words that wouldn't come for what seemed like a long time. "Do it then," he rasped. "Make your move." Rat's hand slipped downward toward the handle of his own lightsaber. Things were deteriorating even faster than he'd anticipated. Yet somehow he wasn't surprised. Perhaps it was better this way anyway. "You really want to take sides now?" he thought. And for the moment, at least, he willed his hand to stay where it was.
Guys, Mag said from behind them, "you're going to want to see this. It's..."
He broke off in a sloppy cough that sounded too loose and wet, as if he were struggling to keep himself from gagging. Mags whistled.
"Oh, anybody else smell that?"
That was how they found the wall. Chapter 30. Taste. Scabrous entered the library through the northwest side, as was his habit. There were five main entrances, but this one led directly to the underground chamber where he'd first found the holocron, so it held a certain degree of emotional resonance. Also, it was closest, and he had begun deliberately conserving energy. According to the hemodialysis counter on the shoulder pack, his whole blood reserves were down to 2 units now. He wasn't worried about running out, but he wanted to make sure that he was sufficiently able to enjoy everything that would come next. Stepping out of the storm, he walked beneath the high icicle-dripping stone archway and strode briskly down the corridor that led to the main stairwell. These walls were thick, but he could still hear the wind whooping and shrieking outside. And after a moment of standing absolutely still, he heard another sound. The low crack of shifting rock and stone. It sounded like something making its way through a pile of brittle old bones.
Dalis, Scabra said. Come out!
At first, there was no response. Then a long branch slithered from the crooked crack in the wall above him, sliding sinuously downward. And the Sith Lord looked up to see the face of the Nettie, its ancient, wrinkled eyes peering wearily at him.
My lord, the librarian said. What brings you here?
I need something from you.
Anything, my lord?
Scabra started to speak again, and something in the Nettie's voice stopped him. In the past, its tone had always been respectful, even reverential, but now it sounded outright frightened. Its fear was the fear of the old and infirm, the apprehension of a thing that couldn't protect itself properly from some nebulous but very real threat. You feel it too, then? Scabrous asked.
What, my lord?
Do not play ignorant with me. The Nettie quavered visibly, but did not answer right away. Then it said,
You refer to the sickness, Jace?
Is that what you're calling it? Scabrous asked. A sickness?
If it pleases, my lord, it is a disease, some kind of uncontrollable infection that has been let loose.
The Academy has been exposed to worse things in the past.
I speak not simply of the Academy.
Another pause, then one even longer.
I sense it within you, my lord.
Scabra stared up at the tree creature's face, looking deep into its moist and measuring eyes. As he looked, he felt something stir inside him. A chasm opening, as if some second chiseled set of jaws were spreading apart in his chest. It wasn't a painful feeling, not at all. If anything, it was profoundly tactile. For a moment, he actually looked down at his body, expecting to see his abdomen stretching beneath the broadcloth of his tunic, the rib cage broadening, gaping open to reveal... What? Something new? Something that transcended even his vast realm of experience? Scabrous drew a breath, trembling with anticipation, and allowed the feeling to recede. Come down here, he said.
My lord?
Now. The crack in the wall widened, and the Nettie's thick trunk slithered tentatively downward through it, wood grain creaking in sinuous little crackles as it twisted closer to where the Sith Lord stood waiting. Now there was no mistaking the fear in the librarian's face. It bordered on panic.
My lord, please.
I want you to send out a message.
Yes?
There is a Jedi here among us, on this planet. The librarian waited. The Jedi's particular talent is botanical telepathy, plant language. Right now, she is communicating with the spirit of an orchid, a flower whose presence she trusts implicitly, and... Scabrous paused. He could hear the words that he was saying, but his voice sounded different to him. As he spoke, he became aware of that hollow, gaping feeling again. Except this time it wasn't confined to his chest and abdomen. It was radiating through his entire body systemically, enveloping his arms and legs and head.
My lord,
the Nettie prompted. Scabra still didn't respond. For an instant, certainly no longer, he could actually feel the presence of transformation pushing up against the corpuscles of freshly infused blood, fighting against it, invading and overtaking it. And again, as before, there was no pain, only a feverish red aura spilling outward to encompass his vision from within. He was deeply conscious of his own breathing, in and out, a hot coppery taste in his mouth, and a peculiar wave of euphoria rushed over him, a promise of power beyond comprehension. Yet miraculously, he remained lucid, wholly self-aware.
"The Jedi's name," he said at last, "is Hestizo Trace. I want you to speak to her in the voice of the Orchid. Do you understand? You will summon her here to the library in the voice that she trusts, so that I shall deal with her and fulfill my destiny. Is that clear?" The Neti garbled out a sound that wasn't quite a word. "I asked if you..." Scabrous began, and then he saw why the tree creature wasn't answering. A huge chunk of pulp, the Neti's woody flesh, had been ripped out just below its mouth, leaving a hole the size of Scabrous's fist. Thick, amber-colored sap dribbled from the wound, oozing down its rough bark, trickling over its branches. Scabrous licked his lips and smiled, still tasting the strange, sticky blood of the tree creature on his tongue and the roof of his mouth. "I did that," he marveled. He'd attacked it without the slightest conscious intent. It had been that thing within, that mouth. On some intuitive level, he understood that this explained the vast explosion of strength he'd felt.
"My lord!"
the Neti managed at last, its voice trembling.
"Please!"
"You do understand what I'm asking?" Scabrous said. "Or do you not?"
"Yes, my lord."
"Excellent. Then I await her arrival." He left the Neti stretched from the ceiling, a pool of semi-translucent sap already spreading underneath it, across the library's floor.
Chapter 31. Flesh Blizzard.
Zoe stood with snow falling in her face, staring up at the tower. "I don't understand," she said. "How did we end up back here?" The Whippet didn't answer. This time, though, any response would have been gratuitous. She knew why they were here. Somewhere inside the paddock, they'd lost their sense of direction to a Sith illusion, crude but effective. And now they were back out where they'd begun. Then she saw the figures. They were poised like carved grotesques along the uppermost walls of the tower, life-sized statues illuminated by the irregular stammering red glow from the top. At first, she thought that was all they were. Statues. Gargoyles. Except they were moving. Crawling. Swarming over the others' backs like some hideously overgrown version of the flesh-eating bosky beetles she'd seen aboard Tulka's ship. And when the light caught their faces, she could see that they were, or at least once had been, human. Their uniforms, which Zoe realized must be the black robes and tunics of the Sith acolyte, were tattered and ragged, and they billowed behind them in the screeching wind. She watched as a cluster of them began to clutch and lever their way closer to the tower's viewports. One of them threw back its head and began to hammer one fist on the surface with awful ape-like determination.
"What are they doing?"
Tulka grunted.
"Looking for a way in."
"Why?" A scream came shearing down from above, the single compressed blast that she remembered from inside the supposedly deserted barracks, and the bounty hunter stepped back, hissing some obscenity under his breath. Before he could finish, one of the things fell from far above, whistling down in front of her. She looked back at Tulka. He was gone. Zoe jerked back and looked up again. Overhead, another of the things on the tower had detached itself and was plummeting downward like a renegade slab of darkness itself, some broken chunk of the universe, falling fast, still screaming through the flying snow.
The screeching thing slammed into the ground on all fours, and even though its back was to her, Zo could see the hole where its uniform was ripped open to reveal the architecture of exposed ribs and scooped-out portion of vertebrae. Snowy air whistled through the hole, and she saw clumped loops of intestine, blackened with a crust of dried blood, flapping alongside the torn fabric. Part of its lungs seemed to have been jolted loose in the fall, leaving one of them dangling, inflating and deflating raggedly like some small, panting animal. Tulka, it drove him down into the snow when it landed on him, and now it's trying to get him out. The second thing stalked over toward the snowdrift, its head slightly inclined, seeking an angle of attack. Zo heard another scream from above, and the two corpses in the Sith uniforms shrieked back their answering cry. Tulka's arm burst up and out of the snow, holding his spear, and thrust it forward. An instant later, the Sith thing on top of him reared back, staggering blindly, the tip of his spear embedded in its face. Its right cheek was a suppurating cave-in of demolished bone structure. The long shaft protruded from its head like a clumsy, oversized horn. Tulka sat up, spitting snow.
"Juddering Yankwit!" he snarled. "This should teach you to jump on me!"
He knocked the thing backward with one foot, held it down, and jerked his spear loose from its face. Then, using both hands, he brought his spear tip down hard, directly into the thing's already demolished torso, hard enough to pulverize the spine, cutting it completely in half. The upper and lower segments squirmed listlessly in the snow, then fell still.
"Hold on!"
Breathing hard, he glanced up at Zo.
"Where's the other one?"
"I don't..."
"Down!"
And without waiting for her to comply, he fired the spear directly at her. Zo dropped to her knees, feeling his spear whisk through her hair just across the top of her scalp. From behind, something landed on top of her, a landslide of meat flattening the air from her chest, blocking out sight and hearing, driving her into the snow. She felt cold, clutching hands and the sticky, oily drip of partially coagulated fluid seeping down over the skin of her neck, where her collar didn't quite cover her flesh. It, too, began to scream, and then the scream broke off with a choked, flapping noise. It was followed by a series of sharp chops, and the flapping stopped.
"Get up!"
Tulka's voice, muffled, came from above her. Zo dragged herself upright. The bounty hunter was standing in front of her. The severed head of the thing he'd just decapitated hung from the top of the spear at an almost jaunty angle, the tip jetting upward through its broken jaw to protrude from one empty eye socket. The gray lips sagged, dangling thick strands of ropey pink drool, and its one remaining eye wobbled back and forth, somehow managing to look both sly and stupid beneath the swollen lid. "A teenager," Zo said. 17, 18 at the most." She watched the yellow eye. "It's still looking at me."
"They're dead."
Tulka shrugged down at the other body he'd left in the snow and shook his head.
"Forget about it."
There was another klaxon-like blast of noise from up above. Zo looked up as far as she could. It was like a rallying call. The snow-choked darkness that surrounded the tower was suddenly filled with falling bodies, more than she could count. They came tumbling in twos and threes from the top of the tower, eyes blazing, teeth shining, slamming into the ground in every direction, some almost close enough to grab her from the point of impact. They brought their screams with them so that they seemed to land on a cushion of sound. In front of her, Tulka fell into a fighting stance.
"Jedi trained you to fight, didn't they?"
She nodded once.
"Then fight them!"
The Sith things were all around them now. Their screams were constant, ululating everywhere, the air itself seeming to stiffen with their shrieks. Zo realized that she couldn't see Tulka anymore. "There's no way we can take them all." And then something else spoke.
"Yes, you can."
Zo paused, brought up short by the voice. It sounded true and strong and clarion clear. At first, she thought it was the orchid. Then she realized that she was hearing the voice of her brother, Rojo. But that's impossible. He's nowhere near here. And it wasn't really Rojo. The words were coming from her memory, from the storehouse of encouragement that he'd given her in the past, when she'd been training at the Jedi Academy. There had been times when she felt exhausted and hopeless, and he had spoken to her, encouraged her to stand up, to be strong and be true. Listen, Hestizo, the Jedi taught you much more than simply how to fight. They taught you how to live within the Force and uphold the bond that you share with it. With these words, Hestizo Trace felt a deep and voluminous feeling of rightness booming through her. At the Jedi Temple, she'd heard others in the discipline try to describe the experience, saying it was like this or like that. But for her, it was simply the experience of being alive, of wild and ecstatic belief, but amplified. All the encumbrances of frustration and anxiety fell away, filling her very essence with an entire universe of pure, sustaining energy. She looked around again and saw the Sith things crashing to the ground on all sides of her, raising their heads and opening their mouths. And everything slowed down.
Get,
Tulka was saying, one arm sludging back to pluck a meter-long arrow from his quiver, moving so slowly that he seemed to be underwater. Zo sprang up into the air like a woman moving through a gallery of wax figures. She came down just behind one of the Sith things, grabbed its greasy, partially decayed skull in both hands from the back, and wrenched it hard to the left. The cervical spine popped and gave with a crunch, the entire cranium coming loose as she ripped it free from the shoulders. The head was still screaming as she threw it underhand into the next shambling thing, hitting it hard enough to knock it back into the side of the tower. A third she grabbed by the throat and crotch, hoisting it up and pile-driving it straight upward in the direction it had come. Behind her, she heard the twang as Tulka's arrow finally left the bowstring. Without glancing back, Zo reached out and lifted the flying arrow out of the air. She did this effortlessly without a thought, like someone taking a book from the shelf. Behind her, across the depths of motionless snowflakes, Tulka stood with his lip still curling to form the last part of his first word, while the five remaining Sith things perched like statues barely moving in various aspects of attack. Springing forward, snapping the arrow in two, Zo buried the halves of the shaft in two of their skulls hard enough to impale them permanently together, face to face, like horrific lovers melded for all eternity. She grabbed the arm of the grinning, mossy-faced Sith acolyte, who appeared to have gnawed through his own lips and the interior of his mouth up to his hard palate. Twist. Pop. The arm came free at the elbow, and she swung it down like a club on the skull of the walking corpse in front of him. She sensed events moving faster now, her hold on the situation loosening again. The snowflakes were coming unstuck from the air, starting to confetti down in reckless profusion. The Sith thing that she'd flung upward earlier was finally coming back down. As the last of the thing shambled toward her, she heard a dull, whacking thump, the kindling sharp crack of a dozen fractured bones.
Down!
Tulka finished, only then seeming to realize that the arrow was gone from his bow and that the Sith things were all on the ground now, torn apart. He looked up at Zo. His nostrils twitched.
Leave any for me?
She pointed at the two bodies writhing in the snow between them. Tulka drew his spear, raised it up, and rammed it down through them both. His eyes were blazing, saturated with red, almost glutted with pleasure, and there was no misinterpreting the grin that twisted over his face. Zo thought that she'd never seen any living thing, human or otherwise, extract such shameless pleasure from the act of killing. Estizo. This time, the voice of the orchid was unmistakable. Estizo, come. She stopped and listened, felt herself smiling, overcome by a sudden surge of hope. From somewhere in the falling snow, Tulka was staring at her.
What is it? He wanted to know.
The Murakami, she said. It's alive.
I thought you said...
I know, but I can hear it. It's calling me. Tulka scowled, unconvinced.
Where?
She peered back through the blizzard, pointing. The library!
Chapter 32, Flame Town. It was a pleasure to burn. The Neti saw it now, latched onto this simple tautology in a way that he had never grasped anything in his long life. Within moments after Scabrous had left him here with his mission, to call out to the Jedi, to summon her here, everything within his ageless wooden mind had begun to grow wonderfully, gloriously clear. And oh, it was a pleasure. A pleasure to burn. Clutching rows of hollow books with one long branch hand, the librarian flung them into the rising flames. And the flames surged higher. After the Sith Lord had bitten him, Daelis had endured a brief but agonizing spasm of physical weakness and distress. The pain compounded by the brooding fear that had been growing in his mind throughout the day. This was what he'd felt outside the walls of his sanctuary. The sickness was in here now. It had violated the barriers of safety and security, and it was inside him, running through his roots, spreading through his branches and leaves. And the sickness was laughing. At first, that laughter had sounded so mocking, so bitter and cold, that the Neti had only cowered before it. Even the Sith themselves couldn't match the dark malevolence in its voice. Old fool, it had said. Foolish old creature, your life has been wasted here among your books. The Neti had tried to respond, to tell it no, that these scrolls and texts were his life. But the sickness hadn't shown the slightest bit of interest in that. It had more to say, and the Neti realized that he was a captive audience. It's not too late, the sickness said. I have given you new life and a new purpose, and you will know it if you seek my face. Will you, old tree? Will you seek my face? What is it? The Neti asked. What is your face? Mine is the face of blood and fire. And with these words, everything changed. Looking around now at the contents of the library, the countless scrolls and ancient texts, the holdings and stacks that he had spent his lifetime accumulating here, organizing and cataloging for 1,000 years or more, he saw them for what they were. Fuel. The flesh is our fuel, the sickness counseled, and its voice was like thunder now. And the books are our fuel, and this planet is our fuel. All things are fuel. They exist only so that they can be consumed by us. Yes, yes, they are meat for the beast. Yes, and the beast is you. Yes. From there, the Neti discovered that everything came to him with oily, gratifying ease. Giving himself up utterly to the sickness, he had started the fire without the slightest hesitation. There were years of fuel here, plenty here to burn. Within minutes, the central wing of the library was ablaze, and the seeping, maddened grin of the Neti shone with reflected orange firelight. Although there were no mirrors here, no means of seeing his reflection,
Dale Liss knew that the sickness had changed him. Whole chunks of its once proud bark had begun molting, dropping off in patches, its branches curling and blackening, dripping with thick, foul-smelling drainage that gathered around its roots. But the most profound transformation was happening within him. The sickness had taught him. He had sought its face, and now the Netty laughed into the fire. Its once kind eyes were twisted now, tightened into knotty slits. Its mouth coiled into a wide, salivating grin as it spoke out in the voice of the orchid. Come, Hestes, O Trace. Hurry. Come to the library. More scrolls, more hollow books tumbled into the fire. Sap boiled in the coals. I await your arrival eagerly. I wish to see you here. I have urgent need of you. He stopped and turned, branches whispering. She was already on her way.
Chapter 33. Red Wall.
Look bigger on the hollow,
Mag said, his voice muffled by his hand. He and Rat and the others were all standing in front of the wall, covering their noses and mouths. The end of the tunnel was filled with a smell so rancid that it almost transcended the definition of the word. In the single breath that Rat had inadvertently sucked in without covering his lips, he'd actually been able to taste it on the back of his tongue and the roof of his mouth. It was the horribly organic, ripe rot reek of once living tissue whose life force had evacuated it, leaving only a mass of stinking weight.
What's it made of?
Mags muttered.
Looks like scavenged metal, debris. Metal doesn't stink like this. It's not just metal.
So what is it? Kendra asked.
Well,
Rat pointed at a white, blade-like shaft sticking out. I'm pretty sure that's a shin bone.
Human?
Rat nodded. Hartwick swallowed. It took him a few tries.
Gah!
Looks, Rat started to say, and stopped. He was going to say, partially digested, and decided that that observation probably wouldn't bring anything helpful to the conversation. If the expressions of the others were any indication, they were holding just this side of gastric mutiny.
The exit's on the other side,
Kendra said, and activated her lightsaber. Hold on! Rat turned and looked back. He'd felt something, not much more than a ripple in the fabric of the Force, but he'd long ago learned to trust such quirks of perception as far more meaningful than anything gleaned by eyes and ears. He shot a glance at Mags. Lightsaber. Now. Instantly, Mags joined him and Kendra, and Ra'at pointed silently into a pool of shadow just beyond a bank of massive metal cases that looked as though they'd been turned into storage for droid parts. Something was moving visibly on the other side of the storage bins, and an instant later it came staggering into view.
What in the name?
Hartwick said. It was the first thing he'd said since the confrontation with Kendra over the lightsaber.
What's wrong with him?
What's wrong?
Mags made a sick noise.
What's right?
Rat recognized the Sith acolyte making his way toward them, but only barely. He was the fifth year, known as Rucker. The left side of Rucker's face had been ripped cleanly away to reveal the gleaming infrastructure of cheekbone and jaw. His gelid eyes quivered in their sockets like a pair of infected red eggs. He was naked except for a pair of black breeches torn open at the front. And the massive bulge of his swollen abdomen was so badly distended that he could hardly carry it forward. It stared at them for a long beat. Then it threw back its head, jaws wrenching open, and screamed.
Kill it, Hartwick said. What are you waiting for?
Still screaming, the Rucker thing whirled and staggered toward the wall. Ra'at saw its mouth open even wider, the mandible popping loose from its hinges completely now. And the scream became a gargled gush as it disgorged a flood of reddish-gray directly onto the barrier, its belly shrinking visibly as it did so. Watching helplessly, Ra'at felt a nauseating rondelay of terror swerve through him, like the shadow of some far-distant flying object, a late-coming refusal, despite everything he'd seen so far, to fully accept this monstrosity at face value. Am I seeing this? He thought. Am I really? Still dribbling, the thing flung its hands up to pack the mess together, working it tightly into the wall. Almost despite himself, Ra'at thought of the Cosm wasps he'd read about, and the way they built nests by filling their bellies and regurgitating the pulp. We're pulp, too, he thought. And the smell hit him in the most vulnerable part of his own stomach, making his gorge rise. The only thing that stopped him from losing total control of his gag reflex was the even more potent realization that the thing was swiveling back toward them, moving much faster now. Take him down, he heard Kendra murmur, almost to herself. And she, Mags, and Ra'at himself advanced in a single coordinated strike. Kendra sliced its head off with one sweep while Mags took out its legs. Ra'at's blow slashed down the front of the body, cleaving it almost perfectly down the middle. Less than 5 seconds later, the Rucker thing's corpse lay on the floor, drawn and quartered, still twitching. What happened to the others? Mags breathed, gesturing at the empty space. Good question, Ra'at said. It's a dead end here. Where'd they go? Forget it. Kendra turned to the wall. Let's get to work on this. Ra'at nodded, but didn't move. His gaze went back to the steel droid bins, near the shadowy area where the thing had originated. He was still thinking about that scream it had let out, high and shrill, like the blast of a living air horn. What if it had been a signal to the others? Some kind of... One of the steel droid bins fell over with a clang. And Ra'at saw. The students of the Sith Academy of Odacer Faustin were gathered here after all. Had been here the entire time. They'd just been waiting in silence. Watching. How many? Mags murmured. 10, Ra'at said. Maybe 12. The silence exploded in a scream, and the things came spilling forward in one coordinated wave, surging into the open tunnel like a single organism. Precision killing box, Kendra snapped. Right and left. She flicked a hand at Hartwig and Mags. Get us through that wall! Ra'at broke right, as directed, letting his lightsaber lead him like a natural extension of his will. He pivoted and swung it down into the head of the first Sith thing that he came to, splitting its skull down to the tonsils. But its hands flung upward blindly toward him like a pair of carrion birds, and it kept fighting. Turning, he came up from below and took out its legs just above the knees, leaving the thing in a slimy mess of its own dissolution. Two more came at him, and he chopped them down with an absolute economy of motion. To the right, to the left, behind, move, move, move. Ra'at unplugged his mind and let his training take over. It was just like the drills in Master Harakan's pain pipe. He'd already begun to see the fight through the mirror-bright lens of a warrior, reducing the battle to a sequence of movements, like a series of doors he had to pass through to get to the other side. The things were screaming around him again, that pulsing, deliberate scream. Like the smell, it blanketed everything and made his skull feel as if it was going to pop. As he chopped another of the things in half, a white-hot shock of pain sprang up through his right shoulder. His hand went numb, just like that, the last three fingers dead around the handle of his lightsaber, and he spun around, snatching it from the air with his left hand before it hit the floor. Everything was happening with crazy, tricked-out speed, and he both saw and didn't see the thing that had attached itself to his biceps, grinning up as its incisors raked his flesh. Blood splashed around its lips like tawdry lipstick. Kendra flashed into his peripheral vision and thrust her blade crosswise through the thing's upper thorax, splashing it down in a meaty spray. Its jaws stayed locked onto Ra'at's arm until Ra'at swung his own blade down on top of it, working left-handed, cutting the thing's head apart. Across the tunnel, he glimpsed Mags, hacking his own hole through the group, his blade a fan-like blur, but the tide of bodies was too thick. If they kept coming like this, the things would have him cornered. Ra'at saw the black oval of Mag's mouth shouting something, but he couldn't make out what it was. We're losing, Ra'at thought, and then, how can we be losing? A sudden crash of electricity exploded across the cave. Ra'at saw one of the Sith things go ragdolling backward into the wall as if it had been jerked away on invisible wires. Now Ra'at could smell the ozone in the air, along with the unmistakable smoky odor of burned hair and skin. In front of him, Hartwig lunged into view, eyes bulging, his forehead a map of veins, but the look on his face was pure confusion. That's not possible, Ra'at thought. Only Sith masters can use Force lightning. How?
Stand back,
a voice shouted. And when Ra'at looked behind Hartwig, he saw Master Harrakhan standing there. Harrakhan's arms were thrust out with both hands extended.
Down! Now!
Mags and Kendra had taken down three more of the things between them and stepped over the bodies as the combat master flung his hands up and outward, hurling out streams of Force lightning. The tunnel shuddered, erupting with an electrical firestorm so intense that for an instant, Ra'at couldn't see past it. He smelled his own scorched eyelashes. Even after he shut his eyes, the afterimage of the cave, the bodies, and the others lay imprinted on his corneas in bleeding plaid patterns of red and black. The Sith Master kept his hands in front of him, muscles straining, jaw clenched with fury. For a moment, he disappeared yet again behind a vast, crackling hood of electricity. It shattered the length of the tunnel with a massive, ear-rending crack that rocked the entire structure to its foundation and sent loose particles of building materials skittering down the walls. Ra'at rubbed his eyes, waiting for what he saw to make sense. Part of the permasteel ceiling above his head was torn loose by electrical shock and dangled on a slew of cables. All around him, the floor was filled with smoking corpses, severed limbs and heads, still writhing as if trying to find a means of knitting themselves back together. Some of them were actively on fire. Others lay blind, their eyes cooked in their sockets. The heat from the Force lightning had literally melted off their skin, leaving webs and rivulets of liquefied tissue trickling from piles of blackened bones, while the thing shifted and squirmed, tried to stand and collapsed back into their own murk. In front of the foul-smelling wall, Harrakhan stood trembling. A tendon twitched and jigged in his jaw, and Ra'at saw that the Sith Master had bitten his lip hard enough to draw blood.
"Through this way," he said.
Kendra pointed to the wound on Ra'at's arm. "How bad is it?"
"Not bad. Did one of those things do that to you?"
"I'm fine."
Ra'at tore a scrap of his pant leg loose and started hurriedly tying it around his upper arm as a makeshift tourniquet. But the blood was already soaking through the fabric, sluicing down his elbow to his forearm with alarming eagerness. Kendra was looking at that, too, along with Mags and Hartwig and Master Harrakhan. And Ra'at realized the power dynamic of the group had already shifted. As quickly as the battle had ended, he, Ra'at, had become a liability. Weight to be carried. Or cut loose. Out of the game. Just like that.
"I can fight just as well with my left," Ra'at said weakly. "You saw. You all did."
Kendra just nodded, her face inscrutable, a map of unspoken strategy. Master Harakan said nothing, didn't even seem to be paying attention. None of the others spoke either.
Ra'at ignited his lightsaber again in his left hand and swung it down on top of the wall that the things had built here,
slashing deep into the pile of scrap metal and congealed viscera, driving it home, carving out a massive chunk of debris and kicking it loose. It dropped to the floor with a soggy clank.
See? He said.
None of them commented. Next to him, on either side, Kendra and Mags also fell to work, cutting into the wall. Ra'at attacked his part of it as if he were still working alone. The smell of cooked meat was stronger than ever, and the pain in his right arm had become a dull, pounding drumbeat. He tried to put it all out of his head, to no avail. He thought of Nictor, how fast he had changed after Jura had bitten him. They would leave him behind, too, unless he showed them that he could still fight. Use the Force. Let the dark side strengthen you. Yet at the same time, something cautioned him about using the Force in his current state of mind. Something told him it was a bad idea. No, not just bad, a terrible idea. Who knew what he might be invoking if he summoned it now? What is your state of mind right now? A voice inside asked.
Dying? I'm dying.
No, that was crazy. It was a flesh wound. He'd lost some blood, yes, but he was young and strong, trained, conditioned. He'd suffered worse injuries in the pain chamber, for that matter, even today. What if those things were infected? Ra'at realized that he was too dizzy to stand. A clammy layer of sweat had already crept over his forehead, one or two drops venturing down the small of his back. His vision broke into a series of yellowing ochre bands and shadows, streaking through everything, staining it. He couldn't breathe. It felt as though someone had slammed a Durasteel restraining band across his chest, the pain shooting down his left arm. Gasping, he fell to his knees, shut his eyes. There was the desire to scream, but he couldn't muster a breath. Helpless, no longer having a choice, he invoked the power of Sith alchemy, the Force itself. Abide in me now. Fill me with the strength to stand and fight. It smashed into him at full volume, a vast black wave, torrential beyond all reckoning. Too late, Ra'at realized what he'd invited into his brain. It might have learned to mimic the Force. It might have answered as the Force. But it was not the Force. Ra'at shuddered. The others were all staring at him now. It didn't matter. In a penultimate moment of clarity, he could actually see a skeletal black fist clamping over his heart, squeezing it until the muscle burst. He could feel his body shutting down, whole systems crashing, blood pressure and respiration failing, as this contaminated version of the Force took over. Mine now, the sickness said. Mine, body and soul. Not killing him, transforming him. Ra'at felt a dark orchestral surge of relief rushing through him. Released, he felt weightless, towering, godlike. A horrific smile gnarled over his face. He began to weep, big bloody tears of gratitude running down his cheeks and dribbling off his chin. I can scream now, he thought. Oh, thank you. I will scream and they will hear me. Bless you. I can scream and they will know how it feels to have an entire galaxy spread out like an open grave at my feet. The thing that had been Mina Ra'at jerked its jaws wide. In that instant, he saw, of all things, a pyramid, as black as the tide that had obliterated all conscious thought, a thing resting in a pair of pale hands. All at once, he knew his place in the galaxy.
He knew everything. And he screamed. And as he did, he saw Combat Master Harakan standing directly in front of him with his hands outstretched. "Goodbye, Ra'at," Harakan said. Ra'at lunged forward. A white, hot explosion of force lightning exploded through him. And he knew no more.
Chapter 34, Reboot.
In the end, it took Tulka less than a minute to realize how much trouble he was truly in. The Whippet had never believed in fate or any kind of mystic galactic justice. In his experience, whatever happened, happened. The innocent suffered while evil thrived, and to the victors went the spoils. Even so, when his own personal circumstances went from bad to worse, he couldn't help wondering if this were some kind of cosmic comeuppance for abandoning the Jedi at the library. She'd been so certain that the flower was summoning her from inside there. Maybe it had been, but Tulka saw no advantage in going in after it. Not when he could return to his ship and put this whole forsaken planet in the past. And so he let her go alone. After all, he owed the Jedi girl nothing. All right, she had saved him. But he'd saved her at least once as well, and that made them even, didn't it? A new kind of darkness had risen up from the landscape now, like some night within the night, so that the Academy's snow-swept ruins glowed faintly in what little light emanated from within them. In the distance, Tulka heard screams. They were not random, these screams. They rose up and swooped down, oscillating in the wind, rising from different directions. Yet it was the silence in between that made him the most uneasy. He thought about the things that had dropped from the tower, and how many more of them seemed to be out there now, screaming into the storm. Tulka gripped his spear, checked his bow, counted his arrows, and listened to the screams grow louder, closer. With numbers like those, he couldn't help but wonder how many he would encounter on his way back to the Miracall. He didn't have to wait long. He was detouring around a long, curved, hangar-like structure on the western outskirts of the Academy's grounds when they came at him. Crushing waves, one from either side, poured in on his right and left. Tulka smelled them, heard their screams, the lurching stomp of their advance seconds before they would have ripped him from limb to limb. He'd already kicked open the hatchway behind him and dived inside, pivoting to get his first look at the high, brightly lit, curved-ribbed structure that surrounded him. The students must have used this place, he thought. Some wit had left a handmade sign painted over the entranceway. It read, "Welcome to the Pain Pipe." Tulka looked around. It appeared to be some kind of training simulation chamber, a wide, high space full of elaborately machined devices that protruded from the floor and walls, even down from the ceiling. Pillars, pinions, retracted coils, and battering rams. But that quick impression was all that Tulka was able to absorb before the hatch burst open behind him, allowing the flood of bodies to come spewing into the space with him. The Whippet's evolutionary process had optimized his killing skills. Now he called upon the full extent of his genetic heritage. The hatchway forced the things to enter singly, and Tulka brought the first and second ones down with arrows, firing point blank into the space between their eyes with enough force to embed their skulls directly into the walls. The arrows alone didn't stop them, but they held the things down long enough that he could charge forward and gouge their heads off with his spear. The headless corpses dropped to the floor with a gurgle while the heads hung in place from the walls, gnashing and twitching and rolling their eyes like hideous masks from some dark gallery of death. That was when he looked around and realized how many more had come in. Dozens. Teenage Sith zombies, Tulka thought. How in the moons of Bogdan had it all started?
Every so often the universe must just get bored and decide to really cut loose. Like the corpses that had come after them from the tower, most of them had already started to rot. Others were missing whole pieces of their faces and outer musculature, turning them into walking pathology lessons without the common courtesy to lie down and die. All of them surged forward with the lurching, eager speed of things whose appetite, for flesh or for death, would never be fully slaked. Tucking his spear into the quiver on his back, Tulka jumped for one of the overhead support struts and swung himself up onto it, shimmying toward the control booth that he'd noticed up above. Anything that could climb to the top of the tower and crawl over the glass would have no problem scrambling up one of these girders. But he had noticed something else up here, and although it probably wasn't enough to tip the battle in his favor, it might give him the edge. And the edge was all he needed. Tulka punched one claw through the booth's viewport, gouging out a hole large enough to drag himself through, and turned around to face the wide, curved instrumentation panel that he assumed controlled the entire training facility below. The dead things were swarming in even more thickly now, crawling all over one another in an attempt to move forward. Some of them had already started trying to grapple their way up into the booth after him. Tulka reached for the simulator controls, found one labeled Swing Arm 17-155, and hit the switch. The simulator responded instantly. Two massive pillars swung down from either side of the ceiling, slamming straight into the swarm of bodies, smashing them aside and sending them flying. Tulka grunted, not entirely satisfied with the result. This wasn't his favorite way to hunt, but the numbers were against him and he needed every advantage he could marshal in his defense. He activated another sequence, choosing one at random. Slots opened up along the ceiling, spitting loops of razor wire from both sides of the room, stretching out as the things staggered and stumbled and caught themselves, screaming. Tulka glanced back down at the controls. The monitor screen to his right was glowing bright green, outlining the entire suite of possibilities for him in a clean, ray-traced diagram, the cursor awaiting its next command. Tulka chose one called Panji Stick and tapped the execute key. The right half of the floor whipped open, and a spring-loaded row of gleaming hydraulic rods burst up from below, where by all rights, they should have rammed the Sith student thing straight backward, or possibly impaled them through the feet. But something else happened instead. The things jumped back, en masse, just a split second before the rods had burst up. It was like watching a single prescient organism reacting to a perceived threat. They moved with unbelievable speed and agility, as if they'd known exactly what Tulka was going to do, even before he'd known he was going to do it. Tulka gaped down in disbelief.
Are they using the Force? Or their version of it?
The question didn't have time to percolate long in his mind. Now the things were swinging up the pendulum arms that Tulka had released, dodging the obstacles from both directions. They knew he was up here and were intent on finishing him. Even the ones that he'd knocked aside had already recovered, and they'd seemed to have done so with unprecedented speed. Tulka's frown deepened. For the first time in memory, he actually felt his confidence waver. He took a step back, evaluating his options, and felt something strike his shoulder from behind. Pivoting, already prepared to rip apart whatever had snuck up behind him, he saw the bright, metallic eyes fixating on him from the chromium casing of their processors. It recoiled with an electronic burble of surprise, and Tulka realized that he was looking at Scabros's HK protocol droid.
What are you doing up here?
Response. Excuse me, sir. I certainly didn't mean to disturb you. I merely...
Shut up.
Acknowledgement.
The droid's yellow photoreceptors swiveled with recognition.
Tulka the Whippet?
The droid's vocabulator expressed a mixture of surprise and confusion.
It was my impression that Lord Scabros already dismissed you quite some time ago. Did you have difficulty finding the exit?
You could say that, yeah.
clarification. It's just across the...
The Whippet let out a low growl, grabbed the droid's arms, and pulled it to the viewport overlooking the simulator below.
Look, he said, pointing. You see what's down there?
The droid's head pivoted toward the open space below, seething now with hordes of undead Sith students. They were all attempting to scale the support struts, swinging their arms up. The closest ones were near enough now that Tulka could smell them.
Response? Indeed, sir, but I hardly see what...
Your boss is the reason why all this went haywire in the first place.
Query? I fail to see why...
Here's why!
Tulka wasn't bothering to look at the HK's photoreceptors anymore. His attention was completely devoted to the components on its breastplate.
You're an HK model.
Confirm. A Zerka Core HK series. Yes, sir, but...
You know what HK stands for?
Response. It's an industry term, sir, but...
Hunter Killer.
The droid made a scandalized chirp.
Correction. Respectfully, you're mistaken, sir. I am a protocol droid, proficient in millions of galactic languages and...
Zerka built you special to get around local laws banning assassin droids.
Tulka was gritting his teeth now.
Those flip shields over your eyes, that's a combat modification. When Scabrous brought you here, he put a restraining bolt on you. But if I do this...
He yanked the bolt off. There was a brief hissing sizzle as the HK's processor muzzle shorted out. Tulka felt his skin tighten, his fur standing on end. He cast a grim look at the droid.
Remember now?
The HK didn't bother to answer. Weapon slots opened on its forearms to reveal an augmented laser array bristling from both limbs. A second later, the control booth came alive with blaster fire. The Sith things recoiled, spun backward, pitched and pivoted off their feet by what appeared to be a non-stop fusillade of hot plasma. Somewhere to the left, Tulka ducked as the HK completed a full circle, laying down a line of fire so fast and dense that it seemed to create a single ballistic wave. He jerked his head back as a laser bolt ricocheted off the wall, then bounced past him in the opposite direction.
Stand aside,
the droid said, having apparently abandoned its customary method of speech along with its former programming.
What?
Its left leg rotated outward to reveal a wider-barreled object extruded from the port. A massive jet of blue flame roared straight across the room, igniting several of the Sith things, and they staggered, blazing, screaming as the flamethrower erupted a second time. Through the sea of burning corpses, Tulka could see a clear corridor to the exit at the back of the simulator. One of the Sith things was slashing its way toward him, jaw sagging hideously, its face on fire.